Hello there. You're listening to The Box Office Show. I'm Ryan Hill.
And I'm Dylan Johnson. Today we're going to be talking about the box office numbers from last weekend and our box office predictions for this upcoming weekend.
We will also be gathering everyone together for the Dune Roundtable Part 2. This time, returning to the roundtable, we have Sebastian Marcano Perez and Carlos Irazabal. Thank you all for coming back.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us. We synced that up.
That was great. All right, we're going to start out with some news. And unfortunately, it's very tragic news. Akira Toriyama, the beloved creator of Dragon Ball, the manga, which of course turned into an anime series known mostly around the world, Dragon Ball Z. That part was the one that got the most famous, put on the map everywhere. But again, truly world famous anime, definitely was responsible for it breaking through, especially in the West. He passed away at age 68 from a blood clot, essentially. And that hit me so hard. Like Dragon Ball Z, Dylan, I think you know, we talked about it a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you definitely know, because I remember I came over to your house.
Yeah.
You played an old DBZ.
You made me
game
play the Dragon Ball Z video game on PlayStation 2, yeah.
Which we weren't able to get to work entirely. We'll have to try that again soon in honor of the Toriyama. But yeah, he passed away. And again, this was like a beloved show of mine growing up. Genuinely, I think that and Star Wars are responsible for me like wanting to become a storyteller. Like, I still remember, it's still on my computer, actually, like, a story, a fanfic, basically, that I made my mom type up, because I couldn't type yet. I was, like, 6, 7 years old. But, like, I was telling some story of Dragon Ball. So, yeah, this one hurt so bad. Carlos, I know you are a fan of, like, anime. You read manga all the time. I see that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very sad to hear his passing. I kind of tried getting into Dragon Ball Z, but I didn't fully get into it, but definitely like it's something that's like in my list of like, okay, I need to sit down and like go through it. Like at one point.
Gotcha. But yeah, definitely a big loss all around the world. But again, like his impact on manga, on anime, it can't be overstated. Like all the ones like Naruto, One Piece, all of them were inspired by his work essentially. And I was reading a few of the posts of like those creators, Oda, right, as creator of One Piece, like his message in honor of Toriyama and all that. And that was also like, dang, this man's impact was huge, which is so fascinating too, because he was a very private guy. Like there's just very few interviews of him. He was always sort of just like very private, reclusive. And also like he died March 1st and they announced it, I think March 8th or 7th or something like that. So he was already like they had the whole funeral service and everything before anyone knew that he had passed away. So that's how like private he was. But yeah, again, so beloved around the world. So rest in peace to Toriyama. You'll be greatly missed. And thank you for all the inspiration that you gave to the world, all the joy, laughter, all of that. All right, let's now go into the box office breakdown for March 1st to the 3rd. Dune Part 2, of course, leading the way. With 82.5 million, which more than doubled the opening of the first film back in 2021 when it was day and date and still in the pandemic era. Huge opening. Dylan, this is on your roster for the box office draft. Number one, I hate you. Number two.
Yeah, you do. I feel good. This is a strong opening. And I think it's going to have longer legs than the first one and longer legs than most movies do. I think it's going to last for a long time. And so I think it's gonna get up there. I think we're gonna do good. Got high hopes.
Yeah. All right. And the next one.
It was followed by Bob Marley One Love with a huge gap. That movie only made 7.4 million. Huge gap. Not even close.
Yeah. A massive change up there. Ordinary Angels with 3.7 million.
The Chosen Season 4, Episodes 7 through 8, 3.2 million.
Madam Web with 3.1 million. And then after that, Migration, 2.5 mil. Demon Slayer, shout out to more anime. That one had 2 million. Wonka, still on the list after 12 weeks. That's crazy. 1.7 million. And then Argyle, 1.3 million. And rounding out the top 10, The Beekeeper with 1.1 million. So the top 10, they at least all had over a million. But of course, it was Dune that was able to hold things together. So yeah, let's move on to the box office predictions for March 8th to March 10th. Kung Fu Panda 4. Mm-hmm. What do you think the predictions are for this one? What do you think it'll get?
I think just over 50 million.
Just over 50 million, okay.
Yep.
It does seem there were a lot of people at the theater. I went this past weekend, like yesterday.
A lot of families.
And there were a lot of people there, yeah. Maybe some of them were taking them to Arrakis, but yeah, I think a lot of them were heading into Kung Fu Panda 4. So it does seem like it'll have a solid opening, which we were wondering about, you know, with the quality, with the trailers. But yeah, the movies are healing indeed, Carlos. All right. Now we can jump into the roundtable part two. So Dune part one. We were almost together. Dylan wasn't actually part of the roundtable, but we got your thoughts right before we went into the roundtable. And y'all had a consensus. And it was that Dune was mid.
Was right. Boring. Dune yep. 1 was boring.
Wow. And so have any of you rewatched it since then and have changed your opinions on Dune 1?
I watched it like 4 days ago in preparation for Dune 2 because I hadn't seen it since. My opinion has not changed. And I'm going to reiterate why.
I have not seen
it. Did we freeze? I think we froze for a second.
Oh.
Everybody here? Okay. I thought we froze for a second. So when it comes to Dune Part 1, my biggest issue is that comparing it to the book, because I was actually able to read that part of the book. I did not finish the book, so for Dune Part 2, I don't know what happens book-wise. But for Dune Part 1, comparing it to the book, I took issue with the fact that they sidelined the entire political aspect of what was going on. Yeah, Ryan's holding up the Dune book. They sidelined Sebastian's the entire like political intrigue of what happens between the Atreides families and all of the figures on Arrakis as they're trying to transition that power. They cut all of that out, and then they very quickly get to the usurping of the throne by the Harkonnens. It happens like halfway through the movie, which is too quick, if you ask me, for it being Dune Part 1, for it being that first half of that book. The first half of that book, the very end of it is when the Harkonnens wipe out the Atreides. And so to do that halfway through, the rest of the movie is taking that very thin stretch of book where Paul is out on his own in the desert trying to find the Fremen and stretching that for an hour and a half, which is too much time just trying to walk and survive in a desert. When you could have spent more time building up the characters before the Harkonnen assault and developing those characters so that it builds into the next movie and what the themes are supposed to be. It also barely touches on what the themes are supposed to be, whereas I feel like the book deals with it better. The theme of like false prophets and trying to avoid or start holy wars in the name of somebody, regardless of whether they are a real prophet or not. It doesn't touch on that really. It kind of like skirts past it. So I just didn't think it dealt with the topic of Dune very well, and I don't think it paced it very well. And it just cut out things that I wish it hadn't cut out. So I had a lot of problems with Dune Part 1.
Yeah, I'll second that. I'm a big fan of the book. And like my main issue with the like first part of Dune was that like Rebecca Ferguson's character was like, she's such a like a prevalent figure in that first half of the book. And it's just like, I don't know, like they just like kind of like dissed her. And then they brought her back for the second part, which I was like, okay, fine, glad. Like they brought her back and they made her like what she's supposed to be. But yeah, like for like I think for like lovers of the book, it's like it wasn't as what we hoped for, but I do think like looking on the outside perspective, it's like I think it was like a great introduction to like kind of like the world of like what Dune is about. And then I think like talking on the reason why they shied away from like the political figures and then more into like that whole stint where he's like in the desert or whatever, is that I think Denny said that like one of the most important parts that he thought was like the environment and like needed to like be like solid. And like the audiences, like he wanted the audiences to like really feel like what Dune, like what Arrakis was about, and like how, just like how hot and like how awful it is to live there. But you know, it gives like resilience to the Fremen and how they're able to survive through there.
I think that Dune Part One was very boring. Dylan already said everything that needs to be said about comparing the book to the film or the film to the book, but it does not like. I mean, when we walked out of the theater, the first thing I told Carlos was, "I am glad that Part Two exists to justify me having to sit through 3 hours of Part One," because, and that's already getting into Part Two talk a little bit, but. I mean, it just goes to show how much of, like, truly, like, set up Part One felt without standing its own ground. Even though they tried to make it stand its own ground.
It just doesn't.
It just truly doesn't. Yeah. And I rewatched parts of it because I wasn't going to sit through the whole movie again. In fact, I was going to take... Andrea, my girlfriend, out to watch Dune because I told her you have to watch Part Two. Like Dune is such a great story, and at one point, I realized that we had to watch Part One together because she hadn't watched it, and I was like, oh, I don't want to do that either. So I was like, you know what, you're better off. But yeah, I just think that Part One, like, just exists to sustain and hold Part Two up. That's its entire purpose.
Which is unfortunate because it had the opportunity to be something good on its own right, to where you could watch Dune Part One without having to worry about getting to Part Two, or watch Part Two without having to have seen Part One. Something like that where it could stand alone like that. Like Lord of the Rings, you could, if you've seen them already, you can just go back and pick any of them and watch them and it's still a good time. Ryan, of the four of us, you were the only one that enjoyed Dune Part One. Did you rewatch it for Part Two?
I sure did.
And you still enjoy it?
Rocks. Yes. No. I was the lone Dune defender. I was the one that could foresee what Denis Villeneuve was doing, what was going on with that Part One. And again, you can go listen to our roundtable Part One where we dive into a lot more. But yeah, again, I agree with some of the issues that were there. Again, the politicking being reduced, I was not the biggest fan of, but I could see why that had to be done in the interest of streamlining it. Again, not even the most ideal structure for that film, I thought, but just the world that he was able to create was fantastic. The way that it does completely immerse you into this entirely new, just foreign alien landscape is untouchable, really. I think we all were in agreement with that. I mean, it was a visual treat. And then as far as the character work, again, I did think that there were progressions with the characters that made it justifiable as its own film. Again, not like a true complete story. Of course, same thing with Lord of the Rings. I mean, yeah, when you've seen them all, you can go back and individually like enjoy each, but those all sort of do bleed into each other. And this Dune trilogy seems like it also is that case, because this one does have an ending, but it also isn't like a fully well-formed like punctuation mark. It sort of bleeds into the next one, which we'll talk about. But let's jump into Dune 2 and talk about that. So first, I like to just collect everyone's theatrical experiences and see how that went. So did we see it in IMAX?
Yes.
We did see it on IMAX.
No, I just saw it on regular.
Dylan, blasphemy. How could he?
I'm sorry. It was the only time I could go, and they didn't have an IMAX screen, so I just had to go with the normal theater.
Tragic, very tragic. I saw it the first time in Cleveland, or the Cleve, as Cleve. Seb likes to point out. Yeah, So when I was up there, I knew I had to catch it opening weekend. So I went to a Cinemark theater, which doesn't have IMAX, but they have their Cinemark XD, which is, you know, their equivalent of a big old screen. So I watched it there, and it was massive, like literally like floor to ceiling. Like that was how big it was. Of course, it was still letterboxed because it went in IMAX format. So we didn't get the full, you know, IMAX frames, but it was massive and amazing. But then I was like, now I can't wait to see it on an actual IMAX and be able to get to see the rest of that aspect ratio. And then so last night I went and saw it in IMAX yet again. And it was fantastic. I mean, no surprise here that if I was the one that enjoyed Dune Part 1, I was also going to love Dune Part 2. But it lived up to the hype. I 100% enjoyed it both times. Enjoyed it even more on the second time. So I'm very excited to hear if this was able to convert y'all to Dune. So let's go with Seb. Dune Part 2, thoughts, overall impressions.
I think Dune Part 2 was just truly epic on a scale that just is, I won't say unprecedented, because we, I mean, in like the last 10 years, we truly have seen some really cool epic theater events. I mean, I can name a few off the top of my head, but like sitting down in a theater and being like, okay, this is an event. That's how it felt. Although I did feel the length of the movie at one point, knowing like the beats that still had to be hit as a book reader, I was like, oh my God, we haven't even covered half of what we need to cover before this movie ends. And I was already getting angsty on my seat, but that might be more of my issue than the movies. Cause the movie was perfectly paced in my opinion. I think it consolidated everything it needed to consolidate. Although I do have my, some gripes, and I am going to address them to Mr. Denis because he didn't go full weird, which is always a tragedy in my eyes. But it truly took what, like, the streamlining from Part 1 that we hated. That kind of streamlining really worked on Dune Part 2 to really just make it a more solid experience thematically, in my opinion, because some of those changes did kind of work for the best. But yeah, I think it was just a fantastic movie. I wish he had kept the coloring of the opening scene for the entire desert scene.
We'll talk about that. I did think it was funny that he was like, all right, I heard y'all slamming the beige sand from the first one. Let me give you a glimpse of the orange sand. All nice and saturated for you, and then he took it away. I thought it was hilarious that he did that.
I was like, oh my God, he did it! Like, he gave us like the most beautiful version of this desert planet. Like, this is obviously, you can't keep that saturation or that intensity the whole time because then it's not as impactful. But the fact that he doesn't truly return to something like that or something that place more like that was really like a joke. It almost felt like a diss. It's like, I'll give you these first 10 minutes and then shut up for the rest of the movie. But yeah, I think Denis knocked it out of the park. Everyone was on top of their game. And we'll get into details when everyone else gives their opinions.
And that's a dub. We have one that felt the improvement. Carlos, what about you?
Yeah, you're going to have to rope me into the second here, because I really enjoyed that movie. That truly felt like, I'm like, okay, this is like actual cinema. Like, this is on an epic proportion. Yeah, I mean, I think like Denis has been like one of my favorite directors, like, of the new age, like, for a while now. Like, I've been following his work since like Arrival, and then like I love Prisoners as well. And so to see him like take on this like epic, it's like I salute the man, because, like, holy. But yeah, I mean, like Seb said, like, everyone's on top of their game, and I think Greg Fraser, the DP, was also fantastic. Like, some of the shots that he was pulling off was like, goddamn. But story wise, like, honestly, like, I like some of the changes that Denny made, which we can get into that later, but I was very, very pleased to watch that movie. And, like, the whole war scene, like, man, when that sandworm comes out of the storm, it's like, ah, let's go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. All
right. So that's two people converted so far. Dylan, your thoughts. Doom Part 2.
So it's definitely an improvement on the first one, for sure. Just because the first one was very much mid-tier, this one's definitely stepping up the game. Absolutely. Technically speaking, of course, the cinematography is blowing the first one out of the water, 100%. Like, it's definitely stepping up the game. The whole vastness of the universe that is being depicted here is definitely a step up, and it feels much, much more epic. But everything that I'm going to eventually compliment about the film as we talk about it are also the same things I'm going to criticize about it, because I think the biggest flaw of Dune 2 is a consistency issue in terms of the theme and in terms of a lot of choices that Denis Villeneuve makes. I think there's a lot of cinematography choices that he makes where, like we talked about with the eclipse scene, where it looks so gorgeous and it's great, and then he does tend to lean back into the drabness that the first film has, which undercuts what I'm trying to feel of the epicness of Dune. To me, it feels like he's giving me a taste and then cutting it back. I feel like there are issues in consistency with what that theme of messiahness and prophecy has to do with Timothée Chalamet. I think there's a lack of consistency with what he's trying to depict in that regards, of whether or not it's criticism or whether or not he is actually a prophet. I think there are some scenes that work really, really well, and I think there are some scenes that don't work as well. And I think there's an issue with... I take a little bit of an issue with the pacing in this movie. I thought the first movie did a better job. It does make it slower, but I felt like there were more scenes in the first movie where we could take a beat and get to know the characters. And I think Denis Villeneuve and the writers felt so comfortable with the fact that we've done that in Dune Part 1, we don't have to do that in Dune Part 2. And so it feels very quick, and we're getting through the scenes, and there's only like a handful that I can pick out that I thought did really, really well with like character moments. Because Denis Villeneuve is 100% like a visual storyteller. He doesn't care as much about dialogue. He doesn't care as much about these scenes where characters are supposed to be talking. He cares about these great shots. He cares about giving that feeling of what Dune is supposed to look like and feel like, which I think is a weakness to Dune Part 2 specifically, because he's skirting past very important character moments that will build up to what is the overall lesson of the movie and the book and what it's supposed to be about. But it does have a lot of strengths, and it is very much an improvement. It's much, much more entertaining than the first one. Much, much more happens. There's resolution, which is always great. I think it is definitely an improvement, definitely a step up. So I would rewatch Dune Part 2 for sure, but I probably will never watch Dune Part 1 again.
Very true.
Crazy. I think you should do a back-to-back.
I would do that. I would, if I'm going to watch Dune Part 1, I'm going to do a 5-hour run through and just watch all of it.
I think something that Dylan was saying that adds to that inconsistency also, and somebody who I think was the weakest link in the movie actually was Timothée Chalamet was actually, like, I think in the bottom ranks of everyone in this movie, which sucks.
I would agree.
And he's still really phenomenal. He still has like moments of where he's out there getting his paycheck and earning it. But then there's other moments where that theme of what being a messiah is, and kind of that switch and that transition that he has to do from not wanting it and rejecting it to now having to embrace it, that I feel like the movie tries to justify through like an exterior means. I don't know if we can talk spoilers now. I think
we'll go into spoilers now for the movie, and then also Dylan, you can let us know, because we have
read. You can spoil the book. Dune. It's okay.
Okay, because you've seen the movie.
I'm okay with it. Yeah, I know what happens. And if they did something different in the book, I'm okay with that being spoiled. So you can talk book too.
Okay, sweet, because I had like a whole segment on that.
We'll do some book to movie comparisons there for sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
But yeah, I think when that moment comes where he has to drink the water of life, and all of a sudden he's like transformed, and he has a visual revelation of what his lineage is and what life is, right? Because of the water of life. I think that turn comes too abruptly for him. When he spent like the entire movie rejecting it, and like visually rejecting it. And I think that's part on Timmy's performance, because I'm not an actor. I can't tell you what would have been best. But at no point did I get from Paul that he was even like remotely thinking about being a Messiah. Because even like the scenes right before, he refused to go to the South. Mm. He refused to go to the South adamantly. Whatever, you understand. He just refused. And once he does take the water of life, all of a sudden it feels like, oh, you're just embracing it now. And I thought that was so abrasive to his character and to what had been, like, we've been watching for like an hour and a half at this point. And now we just had, like, this dude is just like, I'm your Messiah, like, follow me.
Yeah, it felt like it was, like, missing, like, a scene there. Where he has, like, a solitary moment and, like, he, like, truly like, thinks about it.
Mm-hmm. I liked the movie in the first half leading up to that, because it felt like a Lawrence of Arabia type story where you have this character who's thrust into this desert world and is trying to rally these rebels to fight against the governing body that is trying to take control over them. And they have scenes like Lawrence of Arabia where they're just attacking shipments and he's just leading them and becoming more and more ingrained with their people, which I really, really enjoyed. But then the whole point of the book is that he's supposed to then throw away his place as like just a general leader and becoming one of the people and decide to become a full Messiah of them, to lean into this prophecy that he knows was created falsely, so that he can gain control and lead the Fremen to higher status among the universe or the galaxy or wherever this takes place. And I didn't feel like they led to those changes well enough, like you were saying, Sebastian. I think, I don't know, I don't think it's Timothy Chalamet's fault. I think it comes down to a writing and editing issue, because he's carrying a big burden on his back as an actor to try and depict such a drastic change in character without any dedicated scenes to specifically showing that change. It's really hard for him to pull that off. I think he did a good job. I think his strongest scene was the scene in the caverns in the South when he stands up and declares that he's the Lizan al-Gaib. That was definitely his movie. he was killing it in that scene. So like Timothy Chalamet has the chops to do it. I just think there were cuts made, and I think there were writing decisions made beforehand for the sake of time and for the sake of trying to get the story moving, that they kind of sacrificed that development for his character, which ultimately led to a weaker performance, which sucks.
That's fair.
Because what they were doing with Chani and Stilgar, I thought was done really, really well. Stilgar is like so comically devoted to the fact that he's the Lizan al-Gaib. It's like, it's funny. It becomes funny and it becomes satirical. And it's full commentary on it's done really, really well. His character. Yeah,
the moment that both times that got the whole theater laughing was that moment right after he's like, no, I'm not the Mahdi. Like, don't call me that. And then he's sitting around squatting with his people.
There.
He's so humble.
He's humble. Yeah. Of course.
I think, I think that's like for a movie that is so serious, because like jokes are very like loose and they're like chuckles, like they're like digging for chuckles, not full on laughs. That cut was straight out of like a comedy.
It was a good choice. It was a good choice to make it funny because it makes it commentary on how people actually see prophets and messiahs and how people will start holy wars in these people's names, regardless of whether or not they are actually prophets or messiahs. So I think that juxtaposed with Chani's full skepticism and her desire, her knowledge, her full belief and knowledge that Paul is not Muad'Dib or Lisan al-Ghaib, he's not this person. He is just a guy who is an outsider, and that these people are devotedly following him into a holy war that is going to murder millions. Her knowledge of that, juxtaposed with Stilgar's devotion, is just very, very, very well done.
Absolutely.
But other than that, other than that juxtaposition, there is nothing with the rest of the story that connects Paul's specific journey to the journey of a messiah or a false messiah of what it's supposed to be. There, it feels like there's not much commentary outside of that. It becomes very much devoted to trying to show a really cool looking story that has great visuals and great action and will sometimes cut to these characters having these moments.
Yeah, I also think it's like a fall of, like, again, having such a good setup on, like, the reasons why he shouldn't be a messiah. Like, you had, like, Chani calling him out, and then, like, calling, like, his mom out, and, like, hey, like, your mom's, like, spreading all this stuff, like, down in the south and stuff like that. It's like, so it makes it, that's why I think it's, like, such a, like, a harsh turnaround. It's because, like, they set that up, like, so well.
Yeah.
And that whole thing of him being, like, it's like, if I'm going to liberate, like, this place, it's like, it's going to be for the Fremen. It's not going to be for me to then, you know, reach new heights. It's like, he just, like, wanted to be part of the Fremen instead of, like, wanting to be, like, their savior more than anything.
Yeah. I don't know how Fade Rotha is in the book, but what it seemed like they were trying to get at in the movie is that Fade Rotha is set up to be, by the Bene Gesserit, possibly another version of what the Lisan al-Ghaib could be. And I feel like the commentary there is supposed to be that Fade Rotha is the complete opposite of Paul. They are foils to one another. And he could just as easily be that prophet to the Fremen as Paul is. And it could turn out much, much worse in that regard. So perhaps we shouldn't be following a prophet who we know little about. Like, it could, like, Paul is a good character and we know that because we've been following him, but it could have just as easily been Fade Rotha at the same time. And I don't think they stick that landing with his character enough.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they depict it in the book, but it seemed like they were lightly skirting that idea without fully diving into it.
Yeah. In the movie, I think they really expanded on Faye's character. Cause like in the book, he really only shows up at the beginning and at the end, and that's it. Like, he only shows up for like that final fight and then it's over. So I did like that whole sequence in the Colosseum and stuff like that, like really building up his character and that side of the story. I thought that was like a great change that they did.
Yeah. I would agree. I did like Fade Rotha's character.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about what in the world Austin Butler was doing there. But just to hop on the thing about Paul's arc, I think, the biggest flaw of it is his big character turn there when he decides to go south.
Yeah.
He just needed a more convincing reason for him to do that. Because he goes to like get counsel basically from Jamis, but he goes to some spot that I don't know exactly where that was, because we know they don't really get buried. So he went to some place.
I also don't know why he goes to see Jamis. I feel like, is he more of an important character in the book? Because in the movie, he doesn't seem that important in the movie. It feels
like the whole like fight after Jamis dies, like there's like this whole ritual, which we see like part of it when they like drain his body of the water and they put it in the temple. But he has like a life crisis type situation when he kills him. Cause then he kind of like realizes that like, man, like killing is terrible. Like, oh, I just killed some dude. Right.
Cause it's the first time Paul ever killed
like,
a man.
Yeah. Moment of like what it means to be like, I guess like human. And, in this case, both like Fremen and then like an Atreides, like he has like a deeper like inner monologue, and thoughts and feelings on like the whole situation when he kills Jamis, and then like, you know, he thinks about that moment.
Because I love the idea in the first movie where he's having visions and he's not sure if they're real or not, and some of the visions he has is of Jamis like leading him and guiding him through the desert. And then when we actually meet the character, he's very antagonistic and he has to kill him immediately. And it's like one of Jamis's lines in the movie is, "I will show you the way of the desert." And so he does show him the way of the desert by fighting him, by showing him how harsh it is. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. I just wish the gut punch of him having to kill a man and learning how wrong like that death is and how horrible it is was more impactful to him, because it's not felt at all at the end of the first movie. It's not felt at all at the beginning of this movie. All we see is feel.
Agreed, and again, it's like that's such like a, the most. Like, really. I think it's like the most pivotal scene in the whole book. It's like it's that sequence of events. It's like where Jamis dies, and like then Paul, like you know, goes through this inner character moment, and to then fully realize it's like a Fremen afterwards. Even like before, like going through like their rituals and stuff like that, and learning their culture, like it comes at that point in the book.
Right. Yeah. Either way, I could see the conceptual approach to it of Jamis was like that teacher. We set that up in the first one.
Yeah.
This one is where he'll guide the way yet again. But it just didn't make sense to me that, he would go and like convene with Jamis's spirit, I guess, through the spice or something like that. Like I would have.
He just hasn't had any moment with Jamis since the beginning of the movie. Like exactly. They get rid of his body and they return his water to the pool, which I think is great. And then like an hour and a half goes by without Jamis being mentioned. Jamis shows up once when he confuses Chani for Jamis in the desert. And then other than that, he's not there the entire hour and a half. And then he shows up again as the person he's trying to connect to. When we have stronger connections at this point with the spirit of Duncan Idaho, the spirit of his father, like many other people who could possibly fill in that role. If they had built up scenes of him, like seeing visions of Jamis, showing him things, perhaps it would make more sense for Jamis to be a counselor who could then show Jamis showing him the way of the Fremen and why it's so important that the Fremen fight back against the Harkonnens with every power that they have, including Paul as the Lysan Al Gaib, whether or not he actually is it.
Yeah, you could have probably honestly like added him in that scene where he has to like walk across the desert instead of having like Chani like be there to like kind of like see him. Maybe she doesn't see him, but like he's actually talking with Jamis as he goes through that. Like,
well, they do the fake out a little bit where he looks over and he goes, "Jamis," and then it's Chani. Yeah. Like, oh, all right.
Yeah, it's like,
but it could have just been Jamis. Like,
yeah.
And I think that's part of what I was saying in my initial tidbit. I think they shy away from getting weird. They really shy away from getting really weird. And I was happy with seeing the Aaliyah scenes, the fetus. Yeah. I thought that was great because I really wanted them to embrace that. And I knew going in that we weren't going to get fully fledged Aaliyah as she appears in the books, because they remove that 2-year time jump between Paul getting into the Fremen culture and starting those little assaults and trying to hold back the Harkonnen assault on Arrakis. They removed those 2 years. So Aaliyah is still a fetus by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why I feel like Denis didn't embrace the weird, which is something that David Lynch did succeed in. It was embracing the weird. Because at the end of the day, Frank Herbert was a weird little guy. He truly, like, the book there's a lot of like weird stuff that's like not really like explained. It just is. And that's okay. I think things can be weird without explanation. I mean, Aaliyah, Dylan, I don't know if you know this, but Aaliyah is the one that kills the Baron in the book.
Really?
Aaliyah's born and like at 2 years old.
She's a toddler, but she's like hyper intelligent. So she just freaks everyone out. Like described so
that
much.
That would have been so cool to see. Yeah. What the fuck? Yeah. That would have been awesome.
No.
Also, a time jump of two years.
Like
Paul spending 2 years leading these people against the Harkonnen attack would have been much better than a couple of months. Like if it would have felt more lived in. So I feel like they should have kept the time. Okay,
wait, I do want to add on this point though, because like I do think that even though like we didn't get the full 2 years, I think Denis did such a good job on like kind of taking us through like moments in time and like kind of like expanding time as like we're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think the best example of that where like I really like felt it was like at the end war, like the end battle, where they're having the whole battle and whatever. And instead of like showing the whole battle, because like we could have done like a whole sequence like of the battle and like seen more like death and carnage and whatever, and then seen the Fremen mess up the Sarkides, whatever they're called. But instead, then he chooses to like go into the throne room and then kind of like with audio and sound design, just like things are happening outside and it's like just building tension. And it's like, I think he did such a great job in this movie showcasing that.
But I would have liked to see a more violent sequence for the sake of nailing that.
Dylan wanted blood.
Hitting the nail in the coffin of this choice that Paul made might not have been for the best. The idea that these people are following him into this bloody, disastrous war. I didn't feel the weight of it really at the end of it that I could have. Like, I felt like it hit harder for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And that's
the idea is that he's going to war with the entire galaxy. Like, he's fighting all of the houses and they're all going to die. Yeah. And I didn't feel that weight.
I think there's something to be said about, there's a specific shot that's like a parallel to Paul's vision in the desert. I don't know if you guys, a lot of people have pointed this out, but it's the scene in the first movie, which is, I think it's like a vision where he's wearing like that gold armor. And
it's a scene with the really bad CGI.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
And then they do a similar shot with Shani in part two during that holy war. And they giving her that moment kind of ruined that for Paul, because that is the moment that like he was fearing. And for him to have that scene where he's like fighting there and he's like, oh my God, I've become that thing. And like for good or bad, although he kind of at this point already knows that he has to become this thing, which is also a problem I had. Like it's like little things like that remove the, like that greater impact that you said is missing. Yeah. 'Cause I agree. And like, especially because at this point, we've never, like, after he drinks the water of life, we do get one great moment, which is him with Rebecca Ferguson, and he's using his hand to kind of, like, explain, like how he sees the world now, which I think is,
Yeah, it looked really good, yeah. I thought it was
fantastic.
Great.
It was such a simple,
like, there's a narrow path that he must follow.
Yeah.
He can only follow that one path.
And after that, you never see him like grapple with like having to truly become this thing. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just feel like we're very blasé about like the impact of that. And like, especially like Paul's inner thoughts about that.
I think that gets transposed onto Chani though. Like, I totally felt that at the end of number one, the personal betrayal that she felt of him being.
Yeah,
like,
I would agree with that.
I'm
yeah.
now Messiah, which you were against the whole time. So that feels like a betrayal. But then I'm also taking Princess Irulan's hand. But then when he's like sending the forces away, when he's like, lead them to paradise. And then we hear Jessica's like, oh, he's about to go start the holy war. And you see all of them getting on the ships, juiced up by their religious fanaticism. And then they're taking off like that. I felt that. I mean, maybe that's partially because, I mean,
I
read the following book, so I know all the consequences of that. But they do. I mean, they say that all throughout this thing of like why he fears it. But now he's fully sending them on that mission. And then Chani, you know, we're left with her who's not taking off with them.
Mm-hmm.
All her anger and anguish, all those feelings of betrayal. Like, I truly felt that. Like, that hit hard for me, at least.
In regards to Chani, her arc is done well, and I think it has a satisfying conclusion. I just feel like the actual weight of those consequences isn't felt because it moves so quickly. From the point where Rebecca says it's a holy war to the end of the movie, it's about, like, 45 seconds. It just doesn't feel lived in enough. Like, they don't build up that feeling of weight. You just see... There's a shot of the soldiers, the Fremen soldiers, marching into the ships with the flags, and then a shot of Chani, and the shot of the ships going up into the sky, and then a shot of Chani, and then cuts to black. I didn't feel the weight of the sheer, like the scene where he decides he's Elizan al-Gaib, and he defends it in front of all the Fremen, I felt it there because I could see just how many people were chanting his name and just how many people were going to be following him into war. But when you get to that end, the whole battle sequence at the end felt a little downsized from what it could have been. It didn't feel as massive as it could have been. And then the actual declaration of a holy war felt really, really minimized. It felt like four ships going off the battle, where it could have been like those millions of people that were underground, all marching, chanting his name, demanding blood. Like, it could have been much, much more of a weighted feeling to it. Chani, in regards to Chani, done great. Zendaya, fantastic performance. Written very well. Her arc, solid. Same with Stilgar, being that passionate, dedicated follower. Great performance from Javier Bardem. Very funny moments. Very good commentary and criticism. Paul, and then the weight of his actions, could have been done better.
Absolutely.
Well, I think, as you said, I mean, the Lisa El Gaib, when he takes that mantle.
Yeah, that scene's great.
A phenomenal scene.
Like, that scene's fantastic.
Chills down that scene. And that had the weight, because, yeah, this whole time you're right. Trying to go against it. And you know, like, he's saying, oh, the narrow way through. But regardless, it's going to cause plenty of death. Yeah. He's embracing it because he has to. But that was just, like, spectacular. The way he started off, way too hot in there. Even Lady Jess goes, like, slow down. Like, chill. And he's like, none of you can best me. And then they all get up and they got their swords out. I was like, this is great. But then, you know, he starts leaning on that, the prescience that he has. And is like, I can tell what happened to your grandmother from like 9 months ago or whatever. I know what you dream, what your nightmares are. So then obviously they all have to bow down to that. That was great. They do it maybe a little too much, but I did love every instance where like Chani is either standing up or bowing down or being pulled down by Gurney.
I like that. Like, that was great. Defiance.
But yeah. Particularly in that final conflict with Fade, when everyone else bows down after the Emperor kisses the ring, but then it's the Princess, Jessica, and Chani are left standing, like seeing what Paul is like, or Irulan, it's like her real first exposure, but then everyone else is like them seeing how far Paul has come and how far he's fallen. So
yeah, that's great.
That was spectacular.
Yeah.
I think those moments, I won't say that like they did them too much, but I do think they really used that perfectly to emphasize those points of like, four cornerstones, right? Or I guess like all the pillars in Paul's life at this point, and all the things he has to like, or all these people around him that kind of like are his rocks, or in a way or another, or like, but that final one in the throne room was perfect, just absolutely perfect. 'Cause you see, I don't know. I just think that one like was perfect. And the way that in the other ones, Shani is always being like pulled up or down, or like being controlled. And in that one, there was no nobody moving her. Like, she was like, I will not, I'm going to stand my ground on this one. I think just like further emphasizes like all those previous uses. I think Zendaya really showed out or showed up for part two.
Yeah, she was great.
I think everyone did so fantastically well compared to their part one counterparts. That it's just so great to see that improvement and see everyone like breathe these characters more life.
For sure. Yeah. Even Denis Villeneuve has said this, but it's crazy that the new class of like movie stars are all together in this film. I mean, Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, but then we now got Florence Pugh and Austin Butler in the mix.
And yeah, Austin Butler.
Let's talk about that. God. He definitely didn't sound like Elvis in this one.
He sounded like he was doing an impression of Stellan Skarsgård.
And he did it perfectly. It was crazy. It was
a very good voice, yeah.
Yeah, so that was fantastic.
I've been quoting his May Thy Knife Chip and Chatter delivery because it's so good. Like, his performance on those 2 seconds of line alone are like, I would give him an Oscar for that. his Stellan Skarsgård impression, the way he's mocking Paul, with like a sniveling, like a kniving smile, and it's just perfect. I can't believe that Austin Butler could give a performance like this.
Doing all that without eyebrows. That's crazy.
doing all that without eyebrows.
Eyebrows give you so much expression. He's so limited.
Yeah. I already thought he was great because I'm an Elvis fan. I did like the movie.
I did too. Yeah. Just,
he had a great performance in it for sure.
Yeah, he did.
He really had a great performance there too. But I never thought that he could deliver quite something quite sinister like this. And mm-hmm. I kind of want more of it. Give me more sinister Austin Butler, which we got a little glimpse of in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But that was such a small scale role, and he didn't have to do much there either. But here he's like truly putting it all out there.
Yeah. And it's awesome. I wish we had more to his character, because he might not be the main antagonist in the movie, but he's the most memorable for sure. So I wish they had built him up a little more. But if what you're saying is true, if he's not really in the book that much, then there's not much to go on, which kind of sucks. But they really took a small character and they made him stand out very, very strong by being so impressionable. And it is a very memorable performance and a very memorable look to the character. I just, if he's going to be the final fight for Paul in this movie, if he's the last thing that stands between Paul and success, I just wish they had built him up just a little more. They did a very good job. Mm-hmm. They did a very good job. I loved all the scenes in the Harkonnen world. I love the black and white. I love his relationship to Baron Harkonnen. I love his small bouts with Dave Bautista. Like, he has very, very good scenes. I just wish there was more with him specifically and what he feels on the inside and what his goals are, like what he wants. It just feels like he's power driven, but I feel like there's supposed to be more, which if he's that small of a character in the book, there's not much you can do. I get it. I just wanted there to be more to him. And I wanted to know more about the Lea Seydoux's character. The scene that they have, I thought was really good. It was just way too short. I wish it was a little longer. I wish I knew more about why the Bene Gesserit wanted a child to continue the Harkonnen line.
I also was wondering about that. I was about to ask, was that something in the book? Because I don't remember that.
Entire sequence in the Colosseum and like the whole like, That's like not in the book whatsoever.
I remember the Colosseum not being a part of it. Like that would have
been. Yeah, like, but even like epic, the whole Lea Seydoux like thing. I mean, but what is said though is like that's like a thing that the Bene Gesserit like do. It's like whatever they're spying on, they usually try to like impregnate themselves so that way they can keep producing like Bene Gesserit peeps.
Right. Yeah, well, the whole reason they were trying to do that is because Paul wasn't meant to be the Lisan al Gaib. Like, this goes back to what you were saying, Dylan, of like
Fade Rotha perhaps being the prophet. Right? Yeah.
What they wanted was the child
to be the prophet.
Like Jessica's child was supposed to be a daughter, and then would get married to a Harkonnen man, and then that child would be the Lisan al Gaib.
Okay,
so that was their original plan, but then Jessica went her own way and then had a boy and then started training him so that he could be the Lisan al Gaib. And then obviously we see he does end up taking that mantle. But yeah, they're at a point now where they could feasibly do it, but they wanted one more generation to where it'd be more like guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. But that'll be interesting what they do, because now she does have a Harkonnen child. So
it's a girl.
In the follow-up books. Yeah, and it's a girl. So what are they going to do with that exactly?
Have you guys read the next few books in the series?
I have not read God Emperor, but I did read Dune Messiah, which is why I feel like it's critical and necessary at this point that third movie is made. I think Dune Messiah just it's a short book because it feels more like an epilogue than anything. But it's a necessary epilogue because there's so much of that meat, of that, of kind of what Paul has become and what he thinks he is and what other people see him as, and his inner, sorry, the people upstairs are being extremely loud.
That's okay.
It distracted me. Like, it's just so necessary for Paul's character to be fully rounded out. And if Denis is interested in adapting it, I think it's completely necessary. Now,
he's gone on record. He wants it.
And yeah.
We all do but need it.
No, the script is like almost done. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Because when the first one was being made, I thought that's where they would stop. But during press tour for two, when he said, like, yeah, this is something I want to get done, I'm like, yeah, finish the trilogy. Because
I think there's a fourth one.
No, there's not a fourth one. I don't think he said a fourth one. Yeah, and also,
I'd be curious if he went for it, but no, I think he wants a trilogy.
Yeah, especially because I think Dune Messiah is just a good epilogue for Dune. If they were in the same book, it would be a fantastic, like, book. And you can tell that Frank Herbert like had the idea for that so late because Dune 1 itself ends so abruptly. Like, it's like, well, that's it. I told my story, go. And then he's like, well, what if there was more? And then, yeah, he just started riffing.
I feel like he did it because people misinterpreted Dune. Like,
they didn't
accept enough of what he wanted. So he's like, okay, let me make it as clear as possible. Denis Villeneuve, I don't think you could. Honestly, I mean, there are probably still people that will misinterpret.
I think there are people who
think it's an obvious takeaway of like what Frank Herbert's original intention was with like, this shouldn't be like celebrated. Like, it's a sad thing that Paul ended up doing what he's done and that the Holy War has commenced. Like, that is definitely not a great thing for anyone involved.
But that was my issue with the movie, was that it felt like a lot of it was movie, like the feeling of like movie magic of chanting Lys and Al-Ghaib and getting into that sort of rhythm. And I didn't feel like the consequences were weighted heavy enough to show like, oh, us chanting Lys and Al-Ghaib and like rooting for Paul is no longer a viable option. Like, this is not a good thing we should be doing. So if they make a Dune Part 3 and they show the consequences of those actions and they round out Paul's character and they really show where he goes with that, I think it would make up a lot of what this movie, I think, was lacking. But that brings me to the problem of, if Dune Part 2 is making up for what I felt was lacking of Dune Part 1, and then Dune Part 3 makes up for what is lacking in Dune Part 2, what was the point in making each movie? Shouldn't they each stand strongly on their own? I shouldn't be like needing the next movie to feel good about the previous movie. They should each have their own lessons and values and stand separate from one another and work together, as opposed to making one movie and going, okay, but wait, I know you have criticism, but wait until the next one. And then you get to the next one, you're like, okay, wait, I know you have problems, but wait until the next one. I don't want to wait until the next one. I want this one to stand solidly on its own and say what it needs to say.
I think Dylan is my new prophet and messiah.
I am Elise and Al-Ghaib.
Frank Herbert.
Kill.
Activated the little sleeper. So what would be the thing, though? What would give it the weight? Do you just want to see like the montage of billions of people getting massacred on each new planet? Like, what was the
partly
thing the weight?
I want to see Paul's acknowledgement of how he, in his own way, fulfilled his own prophecy. Because there's the prophecy of the Lys and Al-Ghaib that the Bene Gesserit made up. But then there's his own prophecy of him seeing the future and seeing the massacre and him not wanting to do it. And then him fulfilling that prophecy anyway. I want to see him fulfilling that prophecy and regretting it and realizing those mistakes. Or at the very least, or on the other side, leaning too far into it and becoming lost and he's no longer. I want him to become either the antagonist of the story or to see the error of his ways.
I think we get enough of what we should get at this point, which was he looked very regretful and sad, but like, I need to do this.
One shot of Timmy T looking at Zendaya saying, man, I really lost out. is not enough to say I shouldn't have started like, a holy war.
Cool. It's like he like goes out into like the balcony and then sees like his armies going out, and then you just literally do like a close up on his face, and you see like a tear rolling down his face of like he knows what the fuck he just did.
But the whole point of everything was him knowing this decision would be terrible, and then he does it out of what he feels is necessity.
See, we don't.
And we see him being somewhat sad, but this is also like he now has all the histories of all the past, like perfect mothers, and then all the other like men as well. Like all his entire bloodline is all in one. So there's meant to be like a dehumanizing factor to it as well, where he's less like he has so much of the weight of every pain. Like Jessica says at one point, like the beauty and horror, like of all those past lives that are now all entangled with him. So,
but I still don't feel it like that.
I think Dune 2 did a little bit of what I wanted, which was when Paul takes the Water of Life, there's supposed to be a change in perspective to Chani, who is now supposed to be the eyes that we're seeing the story through, so that we're in her perspective of disagreeing with Paul. And they do it a little bit, which works well, but I don't think they go far enough. And I still think we are looking at things a lot through Paul's perspective in terms of vengeance for the fall of House Atreides and the vengeance for the Fremen and the rise of the Fremen. I feel like if we did a full, like as soon as he takes the Water of Life, we are no longer with Paul anymore. We are completely with Chani. I feel like that would have been a very stark contrast to what had come before. And we could have sided with her more strongly and seen literally from her perspective why how terrible this is.
Yeah. I think that's a good solution, like a perspective shift, where now we're not seeing those actions through his lens. We're seeing them through someone else's. Really would have been effective. Yeah.
And they do it a little bit, but they don't think they go far enough. Which is my consistency issue, is that they don't pick a side enough. Strong. They don't strongly, sternly pick a side and say, I'm sticking to this. They lean and try to just... It feels like they're just trying to make a really solid sci-fi movie that looks and sounds and feels really great, which they succeed on all cylinders with. But story-wise, it doesn't feel like they sit down and say, we are doing this specifically, and this is how cinematically we are going to show our dedication to this part of the story.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Kill.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree. I think, again, with Chani, her clear like anguish at the end, I think conveys that enough of like seeing from the outside point of view of someone that went down the wrong path, where it's like heavily betrayed you. And then I think we see enough of as much remorse as Paul can give at this point in time. I mean, again, we see him give the order, lead them to paradise.
I would agree with that.
Will do, and he still does it. Like, again, at this point, he's
not remorseful with it
because...
I would agree.
More peace to be made. It is.
That's why I think full perspective to Chani would have been more important. Because at this point, Paul will not show any remorse. He has drank the Water of Life. He is now committed to this path that was foreseen to him, and there is no going back. And he's not regretting it. It's entirely Chani's perspective that is, how could he do this? How could he know that is going to cause this and commit to it? Still, like it's her confusion of why he would do this. And also my confusion, because they didn't solidly show that transition in his character, why Paul would make that choice, which I'm sure they do better in the book, but in the movie, I still don't understand why he chose to start a holy war that murdered millions of people across the galaxy.
Right. They just needed to showcase more of like him not seeing the attack on the siege, because he was having the visions of the nukes and then that hurting Chani, but then in real life it was the Harkonnens, like Fae Dorotha, attacking the siege. Mm-hmm. So we just needed more of him facing the choice of, we can all go south because we need to, and the people will follow me there, but it'll mean falling into the fanaticism, like the fundamentalists, or staying here and Chani dies.
Yeah, and maybe it was like thing.
So,
getting like glimpses of like what those other paths offered. Maybe like that could have been like helpful to like ease the transition of like...
Yeah.
I must do this.
It's just like there was a scene where they're all like, we're going to head to the south now because we have to. The siege is destroyed. We're heading to the south. And Paul says, okay, everybody goes but me. I stay here. And then he yells at Gurney and says, you're going too. I'm the only one staying here. And then he walks off and talks to Jamis, drops his spirit for a second, and then comes back and goes, all right, I'll go with you to the south. But at this point, it feels like he's still afraid of becoming the Lizan al-Gaib. But then the second he shows up in the South, he goes straight to the temple and takes the water of life. And I don't feel any character change of like why you went and drank that. Like you could have just shown up and not done that.
Not
like,
drank it. Yeah, you didn't have to drink it.
Specifically to drink it. That's the only reason he decided to go, was because they told him, oh, you'll be able to see everything, which was a great, like some of the lines in there, like Jama said, like in order to hunt, you need to be on top of the like highest dune so that you can see, you need to see Paul. So he's going there because he thinks it'll awaken his foresight to allow him to see everything basically. Cause that should have been,
that was the temptation is that, if he drinks this water of life, he may become a stronger leader and be able to help the Fremen defeat the Harkonnens. But then the risk is that he might be convinced he's the Lizan al-Gaib and start a holy war. If that's the conflict he has, there has to be more scenes weighing the risk with the reward there and making the reward so grand that he can't risk it. I feel like it didn't, it like skirted the surface of what it was supposed to do. So it was there, but they didn't dig deep enough to really show that change.
I agree. We needed really more of that. His conflict of why he needs to feel, he needs to see, because he needs to know what the attacks are going to be so that he can make sure Chani is safe. Like we needed those threads to be just pulled together.
Which would have helped with another change from the book, which was Sendaya being pregnant in the book. Chani being pregnant. That.
Spoiler for Dylan, because this is the big one for the book that they changed.
Which they have sex in the movie.
They do have sex in the movie. And I think that's part of like what those like consequences could have been. Like and to give him a little bit more perspective of like, okay, this
would have been crazy, but that would have worked so well. You totally would have thought like, oh, no wonder he's going south.
You
could have been like, oh, there's more at risk. Now I have to be more like there's more than I can lose now. Like there's way more than I can lose now. And also if you did more of those Jamis visions and kind of treat the desert as a temptation, as a siren, like right? He's consuming the spice, it's new to him, and he's having all these like visions and it's opening. And he's being like pulled every which way, right? Like he truly doesn't have his own voice. And kind of use the desert as that, as kind of like you have to see. And to see, you might have to drink the water of life. And play all those other aspects, like you can protect Chani and your unborn child. Like the heart. Harkonnens are doing this or that and like really pile onto Paul more
if they compare it with his trauma of losing his whole Atreides house to the Harkonnens, with losing his new family and the Fremen to the Harkonnens again, and like the trauma that he felt with that, and the possible reward of giving that foresight to where he could beat the Harkonnens with this power, but then the risk of starting a holy war, if they had done that, it would have made so much more sense why he goes to the south.
Especially since the ghost of Leto is so present in this movie, like they really drill into you, like the fact that like he did lose everything repeatedly. They like play that up, and like that's what they're using to bank on, like his emotional, like he lost everything. He's essentially like an orphan now that his mom is not even his mom. His mom like became her own kind of like holy figure. Like if you really played into like he lost a family, he gained a new one, like what are you gonna do? Are you gonna lose everything again? Yeah, that would have been like great. I don't know why they removed that. That's such a simple element to keep in there.
Yeah, and like she doesn't even need to have the child, just be pregnant.
And then lose the kid in the womb.
Does she have a child in the book?
Yes,
she does.
They have like a whole ass family, dude.
I think that'd be a good way to make that happen, because if the attack on the siege happened and the kid died, then that would definitely be like, oh, like I couldn't see that, so I need to see so that Chani and our next kid doesn't end up dying. So that'd be a great fix
like Sebastian, a theme that you could have really written. It's like they're talking, like outweighing the options, right? And then like you see Paul like put his hand and like on her belly or something like that, and it's like, okay, boom, cinematic language. Okay, she's pregnant. It's
even
like,
that too, yeah, because killing a kid would be hardcore. But if yeah.
she's nah, I say go for it, because then it would remind him of the loss of House of Trades, the loss of his father.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah, and he can't lose everything again like his father did. He can't. He it'll put him in a position where he doesn't want to feel weak again, in the same sense that the Harkonnens attacking and killing his father and destroying House Atreides made him feel weak as an Atreides. He will not feel weak as a Fremen. He will be strong.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think so. And then the other thing too, which I guess they didn't want to do that because they didn't want a time skip and they didn't want Aaliyah to be born. But I thought what they should have done is just have her like stay in the womb for an extended period of time.
Like 2 years?
9 months passed, yeah, and she's still in the womb, and it's just like, she's just there and is like developing gestating way more than she should, yeah.
Becoming a superhuman.
Really weird. She can already talk to her mom, you know, she's already awakened. So just like have her be in the womb for a long time and have it be her choice too. Like Jessica will be like, please.
Get out of me.
And then
get out of me. She uses a voice on Jessica. The Betty Jezzer voice. Keep me in. I would not leave.
I also think that would have been a very interesting, weird choice that kind of aligns with like the Frank Herbert vision. Just like a pregnant witch with a witch baby.
Pregnant for like 2 years, 3 years, yeah.
I think that, again, I'm all for embracing the weird. I think.
I agree.
Not a lot of.
That was my one sad part because I was waiting for it. I was like, how are they going to do it? The transformation into the Reverend Mother. Because that was a beautiful passage in the book. Mm. Like, amazing.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. And they did not
go it was for barely it there. It was
in the way
there.
That I wanted it to in the film. The other thing in the film, we'll talk about this. And then I want us to start soaking in all the positives of the amazing sequences we had. But the other issue I had was the Harkonnen reveal of the bloodline, of Paul being like,
oh, I have done. Just throw it out there.
Baron Harkonnen. I was like, that should have been built up way more.
Yeah, that was just thrown out. Dude, there was a guy in my theater who he was a little vocal. He would just like give outbursts. Like when Anya Taylor-Joy showed up on screen, he went, "Oh shit!" Like very loudly in the theater. So there was a guy who was very vocal.
You were in the theater with Carlos.
And I said it privately to you. I was like, "Oh shit!"
When Timmy says, "You're the daughter of Baron Harkonnen," the guy audibly like a cartoon goes, "What the?" And then just stops.
No way.
And the whole theater laughed, and it just cut the tension of the scene down. So it made it even worse than it already was. But he was right. He pointed out in the right fashion that it was thrown away to the side in such a non-built-up manner that it was like a complete surprise and made it kind of ridiculous. So it kind of capitalize on what was already there.
The thing is that now that reveal plays, especially with removing all the political like intrigue, and they do a lot to, like you said earlier, like try to be like okay, catching up from part one, but all the Bene Gesserit plans, they kind of are pushed aside. And that reveal kind of plays off more like an Empire Strikes Back, like I am your father more than anything.
Yeah.
More than like, oh, these people have been planning your entire lives. Like none of you are special. None of you are unique. This has all been like planned, and this is all very like intricate.
This was decided many moons ago.
Yeah, many moons ago. So that reveal doesn't really play in doesn't play as like, oh, look how feeble your lives actually are, that you're just like pawns, that you're now choosing to kind of like play the game, and more like, yeah, an Empire Strikes Back. And I think that's a problem with like the Dune movies in general, is that they really did go for, we want to be a sci-fi more than being a great political commentary and being its own kind of thing within a sci-fi story. So
which is sad, because it had the building blocks to be both.
It had the building
blocks. It was all there.
And if anybody could have done it, it was Denis. I think
Yeah.
He was
very I think he just needed a better writer. I think he needed a stronger writer. I think he needed to be more willing, because again, Denis Villeneuve is very much a visual storyteller. I think he needed to be more willing to take a break from intense and great visuals and just give way to shot reverse shot, basic telling of a story between two characters. Because he's very adamantly, it feels, against that. And I feel like that's where Blade Runner 2049 hit strength, was that it had a really good writing team and a really good base of storyline in the original Blade Runner. And Denis Villeneuve was willing to have those scenes where these characters have great back and forth between them, like between Ryan Gosling and Ana de Armas, or Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford, or Ryan Gosling and another character. Like, there were great moments there, and then at the same time had insanely good visuals to that story. So to me, his masterpiece is Blade Runner 2049. It's one of the best. That is my favorite theater experience of the last 10 years. Fantastic movie.
It's a really good movie.
I think insanely good. Way better than Dune. Both Dunes.
I agree. I agree. Like, hands down, I agree. I think Arrival is his masterpiece.
That was gorgeous, too. That's
my favorite movie of his.
Arrival is also gorgeous.
Arrival just got it. It hits a specific spot.
Yeah, that's another one where he's willing to let the characters just breathe a little and have just dialogue between them, which works really, really well.
Absolutely.
I just feel like Dune, he was so hands-on from the get-go. Like, Arrival was a script before it got to him. Blade Runner 2049 was based on a movie that came way before him. Dune has the book, but he's so hands-on from the get-go as a producer and a director that I feel like he got so obsessed with making the greatest visuals possible, which he succeeded in wholeheartedly, that the writing took a bit of a sideline in terms of character development and character moments, and that ended up being a weakness to both movies to me. More so the second one, honestly. The first one I had issues with plot stuff and boringness, but it had good character moments, you know? It had the scene between Leto and Paul on their homeworld before they leave for Arrakis. That's a really good scene that they have on the coast in the cemetery. Or the scene between, literally, where Leto is just naked laying down and the Baron is there over him just monologuing at him. It's great. They have like good dialogue scenes in the first Dune, and they're just not as strong in the second one because there's just so much action and so much story that needs to be told that he has to get through it. And it's still 2 hours and 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's a hefty, hefty film for sure.
But with that being said, let's talk about the strengths of Dune, which is how great it looks and how good those action sequences are. Because they are fantastic.
Untouchable. I mean, it's incredible.
There were a few times where I thought, like, this is impeccable. And it was Paul jumping onto the worm, riding the worm for the first time. That whole sequence, start to finish, felt much, much more patient than the rest of the movie. And it worked so well. It was gorgeous and it was incredible. And it was so vivid and strong. I liked all of that. I liked all of the scenes where every time the Fremen attacked the spice.
Yeah.
Harvesters.
Yeah. Those were all great. I said it before. I'm going to say it again. Really strongly reminded me of Lawrence of Arabia in like the best way possible, of him just trying to ingratiate himself in these people. And so I wished there had been more down to earth scenes of Paul just speaking with the Fremen and like doing that politicking. They had the one really good scene where he takes his names as becoming one with the Fremen, and then they all one by one hug him. I thought that was a really, really good scene. I wish there had been more of those scenes, but that one scene specifically was really, really good. I just wanted more of them. Really, really good action.
There was one of the coolest things in one of those harvester attacks was the giant landmines coming.
Yeah, that was sick.
Which was cartoonish in the best way possible. I'm like, that's awesome. That really does rock. I think Carlos mentioned it earlier. The final sequence with like the three worms, it's just like,
oh, it looks gorgeous.
Like, that's what it's all about. Like, that's genuinely what it's about.
They keep saying desert power. Nobody ever says worm power. you've got like six worms under your control, and you're just plowing through these motherfuckers. They don't stand a chance.
Yeah,
it's not a chance.
Not a single one. I mean, I would, like, I don't even know what I would do if I was one of the Imperial soldiers.
I would just shoot myself. I would just die.
You could use those like laser guns they were using to like cut down the harvesters, bro. That thing was like,
oh yeah,
cutting them so cleanly.
That was a crazy weapon. I don't know why they didn't use that more. That seemed very effective. but yeah, I think all the action was really well designed. The scene where Paul and Chani are like trying to take down that one a copter.
Oh yeah, that was great. And he's trying to run for the leg to find cover, and the leg starts to lift, and he goes, "Shit!"
Yeah, it's so great. Good.
It's just so creative. Like all those different. You brought up the landmines.
They're really good set pieces. Yeah,
that sequence of just a harvester that's so big, it needs like these little legs to just and then, prop itself up, and they move.
Fighting them, and then the copter's coming around to shoot them, and so they have to run under the harvester to get to the other side to avoid the copter. Like it's just very well crafted. Like,
dude, and the scene where like Dave Bautista goes like, "I'm gonna go show them what's up," and then they start getting like capped the left and right. He's like,
"Yeah, oh, that was great." Dave Bautista he's not in it a lot, but he's really good in this movie. I thought he did a good job. I love when the guy talks back to him slightly, and he just slams onto the table like five times and just starts screaming his head off.
Dave Bautista, I think it was funny.
They're rats.
Yeah, the rats. He was like, "Yeah, Denis Villeneuve, he's the only director that told me that I was a great actor, that I had like something in me." And then all he does in both Dune movies is just scream like an idiot.
Yeah, but it works great for that character. Like it works.
There's something. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's also in Blade Runner 2049 in the beginning, and he's really good in that scene that he's in.
And he's quiet, and he's like very solemn. I think about that performance a lot, actually. And,
him in Blade Runner?
Yeah, him in Blade Runner.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I keep thinking about these wrestlers turned actors. I had a conversation with I've had it twice in the past like 2 months, but these
and none of them with me?
And none
of them. I know Ryan's the wrestling guy.
I know, I'm sorry, Ryan. Like out of all of them, like John Cena is a fantastic actor. He truly is. John Cena, fantastic.
He is a good actor. Yeah.
The Rock has the potential to be a great actor. He just chose his path.
Now he has that one other movie that's like actually like a down to earth role.
I still remember his performance in The Game Plan. I call him some slack. but like out of all of them, Dave Bautista is just, again, he's always a revelation.
I think he's a very good actor. Yeah.
He really, in all three Guardians movies, he gives something completely different with the same one note character, which is hard to do. Mm-hmm. In Spectre, he was great, and that was like a little thing.
Oh well.
Yeah. It was a little thing.
He just doesn't like the movie Spectre.
No, Dave Bautista just didn't say a fucking word. He was silent the whole time, and he just threw fists.
He talked with his thumbs, bro.
Stunt work is still acting.
But they didn't even give him a scene to like do silent. Like he didn't have a scene where they just showed Dave Bautista as his character without saying anything. It was just action sequences.
No, and I agree.
His interest is pretty good.
I have a big problem with Spectre. Spectre is like the worst.
Spectre is a bad
movie. To follow Skyfall with Spectre is a travesty.
Truly.
Yes.
Easily. But then.
Dave Bautista deserved better, though. He deserved a better character.
Yeah.
They should have given him dialogue. He would have been really good.
He would have been really good.
Because he would make a good villain for Bond. Like, he reminded me of. I think what they were trying to go for was the secondary antagonist in Goldfinger, who was the Asian guy who didn't say a word, and he had a hat that he would throw.
He was
supposed to be like that, and I'm like, sure, but
nah, he's this huge ass dude.
he's Dave Bautista. Like he's like a professional actor now who you can give dialogue to, or like just scenes of him acting other than action sequences, and he'll do a good job.
Yeah.
And you didn't do anything to his character to make him stand out. He's just a big guy. Like, you didn't give him a hat. You didn't give him, like, a special quirk. You didn't give him any character scenes where you build up his threat. He is just Dave Bautista, and he is big, and he will hurt you. Which, I mean, works to an extent, but I wanted more. We're talking about Spectre too much. Let's get back to Dune.
talking about that, of Raban's character, which, it was all right. I wish the whole Gurney and Raban thing would have been more...
Right? Yeah, that was at the end. That was downplayed for sure, which was disappointing. Yeah. I wanted more of a fight there.
Yeah.
100%.
Because they were walking up and he was like gearing up.
Immediately gets capped. It's like, yeah. Come on, bro.
I was so excited. I was like, ooh, here we go. Dave Bautista's like, gonna get his fight sequence. Josh Brolin's gonna get his fight sequence. It's gonna be awesome.
Dude, and
he stabs him immediately in the neck.
Snap. Like, who wins here?
How weak.
Yeah.
It could have been something because Josh Brolin and Dave Bautista could do a really good fight scene. Yeah. I'm in full belief that they could do a great fight scene.
Josh Brolin.
And it just didn't happen.
Would you say something?
That Josh Brolin is also great. He's like
absolutely fantastic. Yeah, they should have given him something because they built it up well. I mean, it was like the two films.
Also,
that was the whole thing. They were leading towards each other.
The No Country for Old Men reunion in Dune. Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin.
True. Oh yeah, you're right.
A lot of different reunions in this. Funny enough. Yeah, the Little Women reunion as well. Timmy T and Florence Pugh.
That's true. That's a bigger one. That's a bigger one for me. I'm a lover of the Little Women.
Me too. I love Little Women.
Banger movie.
That was a great movie.
The movie's great.
For sure. So what do we think of Paul and Chani's relationship? Like early on in the film when they're getting to know each other.
I thought the scene they had where they had their first kiss and they're sitting on the sand dune and they're just talking together and then they have their first kiss. I thought that was another one of the really good dialogue scenes that this movie had that were very sparse. I wish there were more of scenes like this. I thought it was done really, really well.
It was lovely.
And then, yeah, it was great. But then the rest of their relationship, it was like that scene and then the next, it was the scene where he gets his name and then they have that hug, which is a little close. And then they have that scene where they kiss. And so the build up,
him writing the worm for the first time.
And her cheering him. Yeah. So they have that build up to the relationship, which works really, really well. They do really, really good job doing that. And then everything following that, they are just now, because they do the time jumps. They're cutting through doing those montages, but it feels like the next time we see them, I think is the scene where they're having sex or they're laying next to each other in bed and they just feel much closer than they had before because of that time jump. So I don't feel lived in with that development of their relationship. But overall, I am satisfied with how their characters were written and how they were written to come together. I thought it was done really well. I thought Chani's character was the strongest in the movie, followed by Stilgar very closely. Mm-hmm. And so I'm perfectly content with how that worked out. I feel like Chani's character was the strongest part of Paul's character.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how it's going to go into the third movie, because like at the end of the book, like he's still like loyal to Chani, and then he basically goes to like the princess and goes like, yeah, you're just kind of like going to be standing there, like, but I'm going to be like, you're just like there as like my wife, my pretend wife, but I actually love my girl here. So I'm actually wondering how they're going to do it for the third movie.
Yeah, I think. And Seb, I mean, I don't know, maybe we could have a quick combo after, but they're definitely going to do some changes to Dune Messiah with where they leave off, because that's a big part of Dune Messiah and where they leave it off here. I don't know how they get back.
No, the character dynamics are all kind of messed up. So there's going to have to be a lot of either changes or work to kind of like get us to where we need to be again. And I don't know which path they're choosing to take, but it seems like they already chose it. So if the script is in fact being written and he's thought about this, then
it's almost finished.
I don't know.
Carlos is in the writing room with him, apparently. Yeah. He knows.
I got my boy Daniel speed dial, dude.
I said, we're getting there. We're about to go back right now. Yeah. have you guys heard Denis' process for script writing?
It's insane.
No,
how do you do that? He writes the script and then he'll go and he'll storyboard the whole thing start to finish, and then it changes for him because storyboarding is so important, because he's a very visual storyteller, that he'll go back and rewrite the script after doing all the storyboarding now that he has a more clear vision of it, which is crazy. Like, I can't
that's like a good note on like sometimes, because like especially when it's like long dialogue, it's like that's like a good way to like cut down a lot of dialogue with just like visuals.
I did.
Yeah, yeah. Which is what he does a lot.
He does it to like an extent that's like, okay, homie, like you gotta bring in some dialogue here.
It's a little too much in Dune 2, but it does work.
I disagree. I read an interview.
You like the lack of dialogue?
I am a fan of it. And that's also because I am the same way. I think he said in an interview I was reading, which is part of what you were saying, Dylan, that he is very much a visual filmmaker. And he very much said, like, dialogue exists because it has to, but like I prefer to tell my movies with no dialogue. And I said, yes, Denis, I 100% agree. The less dialogue, the better. I'm a very visual storyteller too. I do understand its necessities as well. And like, if you're going to use it, you might as well like do it right. Which is part of the issues we have with some of Dune Part 2's moments.
Yeah.
That like, if you're already doing it, so might as well just dig into it. I just think that he is a stronger filmmaker for that. And these two movies are bad examples of why that method or his method works. Because it worked really brilliantly in 2049.
Oh yeah, it did.
Because those quiet moments really, really worked. And he wasn't
working. Dude, the best part of that movie is when Ryan Gosling reaches his hand into the furnace and he pulls out the little paper unicorn thing that he's visioned was there and he's shaking while he does it. It's fantastic.
It's so good. Yeah. But that being said, it really doesn't work in Dune because you're trying to adapt something that's so heavy in lore and thematically, and you could possibly do that with just visuals, possibly, but that would
be really hard. There's just so much like world building you have to do there.
Yeah,
and I think the best part of their writing is creating that world and making it feel lived in and making us get accustomed to it very, very quickly. That's the strongest part of the writing for sure.
Absolutely.
The weakest part of the writing is the character development, because it feels like Denis Villeneuve wants to develop his characters visually, which could work, but then they're also bringing in dialogue that becomes necessary for other parts of the story, and then it contradicts things that I feel like I'm seeing, and it just weakens everything a little bit. But I feel like the world itself is built very, very strongly. Ryan, you have something to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on record shortly throughout the podcast as being a big fan of dialogue.
Me too.
Love it. Love some.
Love some dialogue. But I'm picky, you know? It's got to be really good.
Yeah, it does have to be well-crafted. Yeah. But I will say, so again, like I do disagree with Villeneuve where he was like, oh yeah, dialogue is for TV and movies should be like purely image-driven, which to an extent, yes, like it is a visual medium, so visual storytelling should be
of course
very critical to it. But I also think having dialogue in there can absolutely bolster it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you never want to be bogged down with boring exposition, basically. So any ways that you can find to tell a story or craft the world through visuals, which, as you said, Dylan, this film does impeccably. I mean, both Dune films does impeccably. Like, the world is so well-realized, immersive. Like, you just are completely transported. So on that front, they did amazing. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to, the character work, the more fine details there, I think, some elements could have been done better for sure throughout these films. But for me, like, I didn't think dialogue was the issue with this film and like the writing that I had in particular with it. It was, we've gone over it plenty of times already, but certain scenes, motivations needed to be more clarified, and you didn't necessarily need dialogue to make those more clarified. Like, as Carlos said, like hand touching belly or seeing the corpse, like a covered corpse of his baby, if we went that route, or even just again like a stronger montage of seeing like the siege being destroyed and him not being able to foresee any future instances like that, and feeling like, okay, the loss of my family, the loss of my new family in the siege means I need to go south. So I think that would be the right direction to go in. Okay, so we're now going to get into the final thoughts of the film. Sebastian is not with us at the moment because his internet has been rebelling against him. That's what happens when you speak blasphemously about Dune Part 2.
Yeah, I'm next.
So that part, he was defending Denis Villeneuve, which is funny. He was being positive and then he got taken out. But final thoughts, of course, I think I'm clearly the most positive yet again on Dune Part 2. It's just such an achievement, such an escape, like completely getting transported to another world that is so immersive and atmospheric. There's things in here that I have not seen in any other film, like just truly being amazed and wowed by the creativity of Villeneuve, Greg Fraser, we're just talking about him. And then, I mean, the entire team, like all the art department people, all the costuming, like all the VFX artists as well, like every aspect of it is so well crafted, so believable. It totally pulls you in. And then I do think a lot of the, you know, character work, things like that, the overall thematics, I think for me came through a lot stronger than it did for some other folks. Again, I have my problems with it. It's not perfect. Same thing with the first Dune film. I didn't think that was perfect, but it was just such an excellent showcase of grand scale, big budget, blockbuster sci-fi filmmaking. I mean, you'll be hard pressed to find like a better theatrical experience this year. So for me, it was amazing, a total victory. Got to see it twice. It was amazing. I probably will see it maybe once more before it leaves the theaters. Just amazing stuff. Big fan of it. So out of 5 Sandworm Riders, I'm giving it 4.5. Dylan, your final thoughts?
I thought it, like you said, it was very expertly crafted by Denis Villeneuve and Greg Fraser, and I thought a lot of the performances were really, really strong in the movie. I've already talked to death about the gripes that I have with the character development and a lot of the pacing issues and the inconsistency. So I'm going to try and keep my wrap up mostly positive. I thought the action sequences were done incredibly well. I think it is one of the most exciting things you'll see in theaters, like Ryan said. Maybe only up to battle with Mad Max Furiosa, you know, for the most exciting movie of the year. That might be the only competition it has. But other than that, you're not going to find a more thrilling thing to see this year in the movies, for sure. And it definitely feels like the peak of what sci-fi storytelling could be visually and sound wise. Like, technically speaking, it is the peak of what that could be and what it could look like, which Denis Villeneuve is always pushing the ceiling for what sci-fi storytelling is in cinema, which is why it's so impressive to see him go further and further every single time he makes a movie. Of course, I just wish it had better writing and better character development, but overall, still incredibly entertaining. Definitely a step up from the first movie. Had a good time with it. Loved the visuals. At no point did I... Sebastian was talking about how he felt the runtime a little bit. At no point did I feel the runtime. I felt like it moved pretty well along, and I was never bored by it. I was never dissatisfied. I mean, it's a long movie, and I never felt like I was watching a movie that was too long, which is something that I've been very critical of filmmakers of the last few years, is they've been making longer and longer movies, which I don't have a problem with, but they're not doing it well, and I get fucking bored in the theaters. It's pissing me off. If you're gonna make a long movie, do it right, and Denis Villeneuve has done it right in this instance. I feel like there was no point where I felt too bored to be sitting there, or no point that I want to leave after, you know, 2.5 hours of sitting there waiting. I was definitely enthralled the whole time, which is great. I just wish we had leapt past the issues that I had to connect the dots a little better on the story and the central message of it. But other than that, definitely had a great time. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 sandworms.
All right. And then we'll pitch in real quick for Sebastian's, his final thoughts. He said, I think it's a great movie with some big flaws, but the bigness of the film makes up for it. Grand scale, grand performances, beautiful visuals. And he also wants to give another shout out to Austin Butler's delivery of May Thy Knife Chip and Shatter. So he gives it 4 Sandworm Riders out of 5. So Carlos, your final thoughts and then your rating.
Yeah. So once again, I think like Denis, I mean, he's, I think, my number one director at the moment. Like, he just, like, every piece of his work, like, that I see him, just like, damn, this dude killed it. You know, with this one in particular, yes, talking about like the whole flaw of like Paul's character being like developed and stuff like that, it does knock it down a couple points. But again, just how Sebastian was saying, it's like the grandness of the movie, and like just like in general, being like Denis tackling this like book, which is like really hard to do. I think he did a great job, and I did feel the runtime a little bit like towards like the middle section. But aside from that, it was still like very entertaining to watch. Stilgard, you know, being Paul's number one cheerleader, I'm out here for it. It was great. Visually, Greg Fraser is like reaching a new level of like cinematography that I'm like, damn, bro, like you're going places. Well, he's already in places, but you know, he's going to newer heights. Like that shot of where he's like parting through like the Fremen as he goes to speak with the
elders.
Wow, good stuff. What a shot. But yeah, I think a very well crafted, aside from like, you know, some of the writing things. So I'll give it, I will also give it 4.5 Sandworm Writers out of 5.
You got one, Ryan. You got one.
Yeah.
Look at that. This is a big improvement over the first
one. Right.
Again, yeah. Y'all were giving it much lower scores. So
I think I gave it a 3 or a 3.5.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact scores, but they were low.
Yeah.
One of them gave like a 2.5. That might have been Alessandro. He's like the harshest. But 4 and 4.5s for Dune Part 2. Yeah. We did it. That's a win.
It was just as exciting.
Written, the Lisan al-Gaib, he comes through. I've foreseen it. So
there even, we go. Even with all of the script issues that it had, it was just pure entertainment.
Yeah, like, it was just like
pure thrilling entertainment.
Like, that was cinema. Like cinema, that was cinema.
It was just like a well-made movie that was just enjoyable to watch.
That's the reason we come out to theaters and watch.
Yeah, I agree.
God damn.
Yeah,
it's great experience.
Yeah, very, very good. Looking forward to whatever else Denis Villeneuve has to make, including Dune Part 3.
Dude, and he stole a project of mine, dude. Ugh.
He stole a project.
Yeah, because he's doing this book that I really like. It's another sci-fi book called like Rendezvous with Rama, and he announced it, and I'm like, no, dude, like nobody knows that book. I'm like, I'm gonna be the one, dude. I'm gonna be the one to do it. And then he comes out and he's like doing it. I'm like, God damn it, Denis, why?
He's probably gonna do it perfectly too.
Yeah,
you go, son of a bitch.
Yeah,
I can't even remake it to improve upon
funny,
it.
Funny, it's like when he first came out that he was doing Dune, like Jin was like pissed because he's been wanting to tackle Dune, and it's like so then I was like, oh damn, that sucks. And then he pulled this crap. I'm like, damn it, bro. Like, he's getting all of us.
This guy
just don't mention in the air what your favorite sci-fi book is, because if not, he'll do it.
he's listening to all of us to hear what our favorite sci-fi books are. Anyway, that's all the time we have. If you'd like to give your thoughts on the show, you can email us at theboxofficeshowpod@gmail.com.
Our main title theme for the show is Sundown by Joseph McDade.
If you like the show, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast app you're listening to, and be sure to tune in next week. Have a great rest of your day.
And thanks to our guests, Carlos and Sebastian.
Of course.
Thank you for having us.
We will have to bring you back for the roundtable part 3 for Dune Messiah.
Yes. And you guys will have to tell me what Alessandro's thoughts were. If he's the harshest critic, I want to know what he thought of Dune Part 2. Very, very curious.
We'll do a recap for sure.
Yeah.
See what he does.
Have a great rest of your day.